Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. European Union interior ministers, over the objection of four countries, approved a controversial quota plan Tuesday to distribute 120,000 migrants throughout the 28-nation bloc. The interior ministers adopted the plan by majority vote ahead of a Wednesday summit of EU leaders in which several Central European countries will have a chance to again voice their opposition to the country-by-country quota proposal. The Czech Republic, Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania all voted against the quota plan, while Finland abstained. Nearly 500,000 migrants, 40% of them Syrians, have crossed the Mediterranean this year, fleeing war and poverty in the Middle East. The United Nations Refugee Agency said the constant stream of migrants is so large it called for the opening of refugee reception centers on the EU perimeter. Pope Francis headed for the United States Tuesday, shortly after celebrating a third and final Mass in Santiago, Cuba, urging Cubans to rediscover their Catholic heritage and live a revolution of tenderness. Francis spoke at a Mass at the Basilica of the Virgin of Charity of El Cobre, the country's holiest shrine, with President Raúl Castro attending. The Pope's homily in a country whose 1959 revolution installed an atheist, communist government that sought to replace the Church as a guiding force in people's lives was the latest in a series of carefully worded critiques of the Cuban system during his four-day trip. During a visit to the shrine on Monday, the Pope prayed for reconciliation among all Cubans. Vatican spokesman Federico Lombardi said Monday the Pope's trip was aimed partly at encouraging progress to normalize U.S.-Cuba ties. This is VOA News. Nigerian security forces are cracking down on oil thieves in the Niger Delta region, and they may be getting results. Industry experts say that if the theft is stopped, the country may start exporting more oil. Chris Stein reports.
Pipelines crisscross the Niger Delta, transporting the oil that drives Africa's largest economy. But local communities say they benefit little from the wealth being pumped out of their backyard. So for years, thieves have been stealing crude from pipelines and selling it to illegal refineries to make money. Industry analysts and oil companies say thefts cut oil production by tens of thousands of barrels per day. President Muhammadu Buhari overhauled the leaderships of the military and the state oil company after taking office in May. Since then, security agencies have announced several raids on illegal refineries and the arrests of thieves. Oil production in Nigeria is expected to rise from about 1.8 million barrels per day in August to 2.1 million barrels per day this month, and could reach 2.2 million barrels per day by the end of the year. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Chinese President Xi Jinping, who begins a U.S. visit Tuesday, said his government takes cybersecurity seriously and that cyber criminals, including hackers stealing commercial secrets, should be punished according to the law and international conventions. In a written comments published early Tuesday in response to questions from the Wall Street Journal, she said China has also been a victim of hacking and denied any governmental role in stealing business data. She told the Wall Street Journal he is ready to boost cooperation with the U.S. on the issue of cybercrime. Airport officials in Yemen say President Abdul Rabu Mansour Hadi has arrived in the southern port city of Aden following a six-month exile. Hadi fled to Saudi Arabia in March as Shiite Houthi rebels closed in on his refuge in Aden. Last week, Yemen's cabinet returned to the country after spending months in exile in Saudi Arabia. The cabinet is working out of Aden with a goal of restoring stability to the country. German car manufacturer Volkswagen says 11 million cars worldwide were fitted with software that was designed to cheat U.S. emission tests. It announced on Tuesday that it is putting aside some $7.3 billion to handle the cost of changing the software and other expenses in hopes of winning back the trust of our customers. Volkswagen released a statement saying it is working intensely to eliminate the deviations that allowed Volkswagen to outwit U.S. emission standards. Volkswagen Chief Executive Martin Winterkorn apologized for deceiving customers and regulators and promised to cooperate with all investigators. Along with having to pay to fix the rigged cars, Volkswagen could face as much as $18 billion in fines. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
What we need to urgently move from is a situation where countries are closing borders or taking these individual actions to deal with it to a system where there's a united response to this from across Europe.
That's Adrian Edwards of the UN Refugee Agency calling on European leaders to take decisive action to deal with the migrant and refugee crisis. Details are coming up. Also, Burkina Faso army troops enter the capital Ouagadougou to negotiate the surrender of coup leaders. Pope Francis is headed to the United States to begin his highly anticipated seven-day visit. Born Free USA applauds a move by the U.S. Congress to protect African wildlife. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Gabon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: in Burkina Faso, army troops entered the capital city overnight without resistance. They are asking Presidential Guard members who carried out last week's coup to lay down their weapons. Coup leader General Gilbert Diendéré says he is optimistic about the outcome of discussions. Emily Yeo reports from Ouagadougou.
People were out and about Tuesday in Ouagadougou with only a few army trucks seen driving through the streets. Army troops entered the city overnight, but most stay inside military camps as military chiefs talk with coup leader Gilbert Diendéré. Speaking at a news conference, the general denied the army had given him an ultimatum and say he wants to avoid confrontation.
Nous n'avons pas envie de nous battre. Bon, nous défendrons éventuellement, mais nous n'avons pas envie de verser du sang.
He says the presidential guards, also known as the RSP, do not want to fight. He says that they will defend themselves if they have to, but they do not want to shed blood to stay in power, that it is useless to commit massacres for a country they want to serve. The RSP seized power in a coup last Wednesday. They said the transition government was not organizing free and fair elections. Diendéré asked for all candidates to be allowed to run, including former members of Blaise Compaoré's government. Compaoré was president of Burkina Faso for 27 years before being ousted last year following massive protests over his plan to change the constitution so he could seek another term. After several days of crisis, West African mediators announced a proposed peace deal Sunday. In exchange for giving back power to the transitional government and releasing Prime Minister Isaac Zida, Diendéré and the RSP soldiers will receive amnesty. On Monday, soon after the news broke of the army stepping in, Diendéré agreed to the conditions of the peace deal. The Prime Minister has reportedly been released. But anti-coup protesters disagreed with the proposed amnesty. The peace deal is due to be addressed at an ECOWAS summit Tuesday in Nigeria. Diendéré said whatever West African countries conclude, he will take it into account.
Nous attendrons et nous appliquerons ce que les chefs d'État vont décider.
He says the coup backers are waiting and they will enforce whatever the heads of state will decide at the ECOWAS meeting. If they agree with the amnesty, that is good, he says. If not, they will take it into account. Since the onset of the crisis, at least 10 people have been killed and more than 100 have been injured. Emily Yab for VOA News from Ouagadougou.
A new report says Europe could receive more than 1 million migrants and refugees this year, and that half of them would be eligible for asylum. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, estimates that Europe has the capacity and the moral obligation to accommodate the wave of refugees. The report says migration has been the biggest engine of democratic growth in the EU since the mid-1990s. It predicts migration will soon be the only source. The Paris-based policy group recommends offering financial support to some smaller member states, such as Poland, Hungary, and Bulgaria, to deal with the crisis. The OECD warns that failure to agree on a joint emergency plan would fuel xenophobia. Well, the UN Refugee Agency is urging EU leaders to approve emergency proposals to deal with Europe's refugee and migrant crisis. The UNHCR warns this week's meeting in Brussels may be the last opportunity for a coherent response. Adrian Edwards is a spokesman for the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about European efforts to control the crisis.
Over the last week or two, we've seen the result of a very divided approach across Europe to dealing with the 470,000 or so refugees and migrants who've been arriving here in Europe this year. And that's been reflected in people being pushed from one country to another, scenes of chaos, confusion at different borders around Europe. As countries work individually to deal with this. But what we need to urgently move from is a situation where countries are closing borders or taking these individual actions to deal with it to a system where there's a united response to this from across Europe. If we don't get that united response, it's going to be extraordinarily hard to manage this situation of so many people arriving in Europe fleeing war.
Now, the number you mentioned, the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees, is a lot higher than the number being considered by EU leaders for relocation. So how does that jibe?
Well, relocation has to get moving for this situation to begin being brought under control. Already the EU has agreed to 40,000 relocations, and that needs to start actually being implemented and happening. Next, there has to really be a larger scale relocation. We hope this week's meetings will move forward on that in Europe. You're right, it won't answer the whole problem in Europe, but it's a vital first that's going to be needed. And then a lot more is going to be needed after that. And that includes additional relocation. It includes resettlement of refugees in countries beyond Europe as well. And it includes a whole raft of other measures, including the setting up of asylum reception centres in Greece, improved facilities for helping register screening people who arrive by sea, also strengthening of these sort of capacities that already do exist to some degree in Italy. There needs to be better mechanisms in place for looking at who is a refugee and who isn't and those who aren't. We have to see what can be done to organise that, and that's mainly a factor for countries to deal with through their immigration procedures, looking at humane returns of people not in need of refugee status. And then there's a whole raft of other measures which look at how we can stabilize the broader situation. Today, you've got 60 million people forcibly displaced worldwide. 20 million of those are refugees. Large numbers of these people are on the move. The war in Syria has been a major factor in that. And yet, at the same time, we don't see two things happening. Either the root causes being addressed, or sufficient funding for many of these refugee situations. And that kind of thing has real consequences. Today, if you're in Lebanon or Jordan, you may be receiving just 45 cents a day for your family for their food needs. Your children may not be in school. Poverty rates among refugees are rising. Inadequate support for the hosting communities means relationships between host communities and refugees are being affected. So there is a real problem of stabilizing the situation in these regions and bringing better funding to the needs there too.
UNHCR says the problem gets much worse by the day. It's estimating 6,000 people arriving every day on European shores. Has the agency been able to project through the end of the year just how many migrants and refugees are going to be coming to Europe?
Tragically, the underlying causes of this movement, these terrible conflicts in the Syria region in particular, but also we're seeing people coming from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Somalia, Eritrea, other refugee-producing countries. Sadly, these underlying situations remain without solution to them. So more people are on the way. What you have seen in Europe is real evidence that countries working alone to try and deal with these problems just doesn't work. You don't solve a situation of people fleeing war by closing your doors to them. The risks for refugees increase, the risks of people smugglers profiting from this grows, and you have ensuing problems of deteriorating relationships between countries where people are being received and the refugees that are arriving.
Adrian Edwards is a spokesman for the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. The UNHCR, or UN envoy to Libya, has said two rival governments and their militias must make a decision about unification within the next month. Bernardino Leon met with delegations from Tripoli and Al-Baida last night. They told them that they must reach a compromise by October 20th, the date when a legal mandate for democratically elected legislatures in Al-Baida expires. After 1 year of UN-brokered negotiations, the rivals reached a consensus on a draft general national accord. The UN's special envoy has said the work will be finished. He said he very much hopes that in the coming days that the parties will be back and ready to discuss names. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Well, Pope Francis is headed to the United States today after celebrating a third and final mass on the communist island of Cuba. U.S. President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle, along with Vice President Joe Biden and his wife Jill, will greet Pope Francis when he arrives at Joint Base Andrews outside of Washington this afternoon. Pope Francis will try to promote dialogue between the American Church's liberal and conservative factions. It's part of a busy period of travel for the pontiff, who will also visit Africa in November. In the second part of his two-part series on the pontiff, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to Paul Vallely, author of Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. He asked him about the pope's evolving relationship with Africa's estimated 175 million Catholics and their leaders.
He's the first pope from the global south. He's the first pope who looks at the world down a different end of the telescope than the rich world. And he's the first pope who understands issues of economic and cultural domination by the rich world. So he talks about things like ideological colonization. And this is something that African bishops have talked about, the idea that the West wants to colonize Africa again with new ideas. And they're talking about attitudes to homosexuality and divorce and so forth. The Pope knows that the template that he has of looking at, say, his big neighbor, the United States, from the point of view of Latin America and feeling like the little brother or the victim, he knows that that has resonance in Africa, but he understands that culturally Africa is different, and he's aware that he needs to learn about it. He's coming to Africa in November. He's going to Kenya, Uganda, and then the Central African Republic. It's his 11th foreign trip, and only now is Africa taking part of his time, as it were. So it gives you an idea that it's not very high up his priorities, but he's aware of the fact that he's neglected it and that he needs to know more about it.
Do you want to say something about African Catholicism per se? I mean, perhaps what the reaction has been or might come to be regarding this new pope.
The Pope has got two contradictory impulses. One is that he wants to change the way that the Church makes decisions and allow places like Africa and other parts of the Church throughout the world to have more influence on the way that decisions are made centrally in Rome. And he wants the Vatican to become the servant of the wider Church and not its master. But he also has particular views on issues like divorced Catholics and how they should be allowed back into receiving communion in church, which has become a big issue of disagreement. And a lot of the Africans bishops disagree with him on that and feel that the church should hold a hard line on divorce, remarriage, homosexuality, and other issues of sexual ethics. Here, the Pope is as it were, torn in two directions. He wants to allow people around the world to have their view and to take part in the decision-making process, but he's not always necessarily comfortable with the views they express.
Of course, AIDS is a huge issue in Africa, too, and that's something where the Church can serve, but also has something to say, at least historically, in terms of sexual ethics.
The main concerns that he'll have in Africa, the propagation of the faith. There's a shortage of priests, but lay catechists are very strong. He'll be talking about the martyrs who were killed in the 1880s in Uganda, who were made martyrs by Pope Paul VI in the 60s. It's the 50th anniversary of that, and he'll be talking about that. He'll raise issues of persecution. He'll be talking about Boko Haram, not by name, but indirectly, I would imagine. And he'll be very keen on talking about praising the work that the church has done in terms of schools and hospitals throughout the continent. So those will be his focuses. I don't think he'll be particularly focused on issues of sexuality. And it will be interesting to see whether he mentions AIDS and the controversy that some people feel that the church's attitude to contraception and condoms has been part of the problem and not part of the solution.
That was Paul Vulalea, author of Pope Francis, The Struggle for the Soul of Catholicism. He spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The Global Wildlife Conservation Organization, Born Free USA, applauds a move by U.S. Congress to protect African wildlife. Last week, Congressman Paul Grijalva of Arizona introduced a bill called the Conserving Ecosystems by Ceasing the Importation of Large Animals Trophies Act. It's nicknamed the Cecil Act, which refers to the name of a well-known lion in Zimbabwe killed recently by an American hunter. The bill is a companion to one introduced in late July. It would prohibit the importation of trophies from species that are threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act, but have not yet been listed. Adam Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA and the Born Free Foundation. He says legislation is a long-awaited critical step in ending the unsustainable and unsportsmanlike practice of trophy hunting.
Well, I think it's not only important in regards to trophy hunting, but these new acts injected into Congress for consideration to ban trophies would also ban other products and commercial trade and endangered species, which is incredibly important because I think what we find with the Endangered Species Act all too often is that it becomes this emergency room approach to a clinical problem with the way that we look at saving wildlife around the world. And sometimes the ESA is applied when it becomes critical for endangered species. And what we don't want to do is have a situation in which animals are languishing while the Fish and Wildlife Service is making a decision. So these acts, like the Cecil Act, conserving ecosystems by ceasing the importation of large animal trophies, would basically apply the ESA protection to these species when they are proposed for listing, rather than the Fish and Wildlife Service having to ultimately make its final determination first.
How has the killing of Cecil the Lion impacted your efforts for animal welfare?
Well, for Born Free and a number of other organizations around the world, I think what happened when Cecil the Lion was killed was that it really put literally a face and a name to the issues that we've been talking about for some time. You know, we've been talking about the number of lions that are killed across Africa for trophies, much more than 500 every year, with more than 60% of those being killed by American trophy hunters. So we've long highlighted the problem, but those, for many people, are just numbers. It's a very foreign concept to think about these issues. So when Cecil was killed, it really did sort of highlight the individual that is involved in this. And when you take an individual like Cecil out of the family system and out of the ecosystem, it has dire consequences. And for some people, you have to have that kind of individual animal to identify with in order to amplify the overall problem.
Also, I understand that the act will still allow for some trophy hunting if they get a permit.
The Endangered Species Act, as it's currently written, does have an exemption provision where somebody can apply to the Fish and Wildlife Service for a special permit to suggest that somehow by killing or capturing an individual animal that is listed as an endangered species, it will enhance the conservation of the species in the wild. And what this law basically says is that if it's enacted, it would extend those ESA prohibitions on killing or otherwise taking wild animals that are protected under the ESA. It would extend those provisions to proposed species, and that would mean that if species like the lion is proposed for listing, someone could still apply for that kind of permit to get an exemption. So it's no different than what the current ESA allows.
Then how will it really help the lion population in Africa? Will it increase it or just keep it steady as it is now?
Well, I think what we've seen over the course of, you know, many decades since 1973, the ESA does protect wild animals that are threatened with extinction, and it does allow those populations to recover. It is an incredibly effective tool. For example, using the lion specifically, Born Free and others petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the lion as endangered back in March of 2011, and we're still waiting for a final decision. But the service in October of last year actually put out its proposed rule to list the lion as threatened with some exemption provisions. And so what this law, had it been in place already, would do is say that the lion actually is protected under the ESA while the proposed rule from last year is being finalized. And of course, had that been the case in this past year, Cecil may never have been killed, because Cecil probably would not have had a permit allowed to kill that animal and bring the trophy back into the country. So it actually could prove really important, this kind of law, both for an individual animal but also for a population or a species like lions.
How will this be enforced through the African government?
Well, it's really about the Fish and Wildlife Service more than anything else, making sure that no permits are given and that no trophies are imported. So much like the Fish and Wildlife Service has a really amazing division of law enforcement that's out enforcing the ESA and other wildlife protection laws, that would just apply in this case as well. And they would know that there are certain species that would be proposed for listing, and therefore those trophies couldn't come back into the country or other products for commercial trade.
Looking ahead, what do you see in the future for the lion population?
Well, I think a number of things. One is we have state laws around the country now being introduced in state legislatures to stop the import of trophies into those states. We've got these acts at the federal level, and we've got the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species, or CITES, which is a global wildlife trade treaty, all looking at lion issues in the next year. And coming up in the next year, you'll see some of these laws pass. You'll see the ESA listing for the lion probably early in the new year finalized, and then in November of next year, when the Conference of the Parties to CITES meets, you might see increased international protection for lions in trade. So I think the next 12 months are really going to be a pivotal time for the conservation of African lions.
That was Adam M. Roberts, CEO of Born Free USA and the Born Free Foundation. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Join with leaders like President Sirleaf.
Malaria stops footballers from scoring and students from learning.
And join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
United, we can beat malaria.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of The Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burkina Faso army troops enter the capital Ouagadougou to negotiate the surrender of coup leaders. It is estimated Europe will receive more than a million migrants this year, and a half of them will be eligible for asylum. And Pope Francis begins his highly anticipated seven-day visit to the United States. Coming up, we'll have music from Gabon and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with Rugby World Cup.
Kim, the Rugby World Cup resumes Wednesday with three matches. Australia will play Fiji in Cardiff, Wales. France will face Romania at the Olympic Stadium in London. And Scotland will take on surprise package Japan in Gloucester, England. The brave blossoms of Japan showed bravery and fight in edging two-time world champion South Africa 34-32 in their opening match. It's a result that's been described as the biggest upset in Rugby World Cup history. Substitute Carney Hesketh scored on the last play of the game to seal the upset victory for the Japanese, who some odds makers had as 1,000-1 underdogs before the match. Michael Leach plays in the back row and captains the brave blossoms of Japan. Michael was born in New Zealand, and his family moved to Japan when he was 15. Now 26, Leach has learned the Japanese language and culture and become one of the Asian country's sports heroes. He looks back over that big win over the Springboks of South Africa and looks ahead to Wednesday's opponent, the Bravehearts of Scotland.
The preparation against South Africa was, you know, was probably the best preparation we've had, and we've been working for the last 2.5 years to beat South Africa, and to beat them was obviously a huge achievement. After beating them, it was a bit overwhelming having, you know, you turn your cell phone on and there's honestly like 200 messages. You know, all the media, you know, they're all into you, and walking down the street, everyone wants to buy you a beer, slap on your back. So that experience was something special that the Japanese players that they have never experienced. Yeah, so from now on, so we've addressed what could disrupt us in our preparation, and the players are all switched on and focused on beating Scotland.
Scotland will be playing its first match in the 20-team tournament. Japan's head coach, Eddie Jones, says he doesn't think his squad will have a letdown after the tremendous triumph against South Africa.
Well, if the players can't get excited after Saturday, I don't know what's going to excite them. And they're excited, so I don't think we've got to worry in that regard. Like, motivation's not an issue. We've dress rehearsed this probably 3 times over the last 2 years, had 4-day turnarounds. You know, we played Wales 2 years ago, beat them on the Saturday, played Canada on the Wednesday, beat them, then played America on the Sunday and beat them. So, you know, these guys can do it. Japanese players are enormously resilient. You know, so it's one thing in our favour.
That's Eddie Jones, the head coach of Japan's national rugby team. Coach Jones says the Brave Blossoms have two big targets at the Rugby World Cup: to make the quarterfinals and to be the team of the tournament. I encourage our VOA listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. On my Facebook page today, Tuesday,
You can check out a nice photo of the brave blossoms of Japan celebrating their victory over South Africa. And on the Twitter front, I got a tweet today from Austin Okon-Akpan, my friend at VOA Partner Channels Television in Nigeria. Austin tweeted, "We live in an action-packed world of sports, so keep talking sports."
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
In African club football, two Sudanese clubs will be hosting first leg matches on Saturday and Sunday in Omdurman in the semifinals of the CAF Champions League. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports for a look at the Final Four is our African football guru, David Legg.
Yes, Sonny, and the semifinal lineup will have two Sudanese clubs, not something I think anybody would have expected at the beginning of the season way back in February. Al Hilal, they will play Ousma of Algeria, and then Al Marek will play Mazembe of DR Congo. I guess Mazembe must be the favourites now. They've won the competition four times. None of the other clubs have won the competition. And Mazembe really were impressive. They took Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco apart, winning 5-0 in Lubumbashi, easily their most impressive performance of the season. Despite the fact that Tetouan had lost by 5 goals, they still would have qualified for the semifinals if Hilal had lost at Smouha of Egypt. And for a long time, Hilal were trailing. But midway through the second half, the Sudanese equalized. They forced a 1-1 draw. And on the basis of that point, they went through to the semifinals. In the other group, Sonny, it was already a foregone conclusion. It was really a question of pride at stake. The match between Ousma of Algeria and Marek in Sudan ended 1-0 in favor of Marek, a big morale boost for them. And then a really disappointing Entente Setif, the defending champions. They could only manage a 2-2 draw at home to Mouloudia El Ulma in an all-Algerian affair. And that, after 5 consecutive defeats, was the first point that Ulma achieved in the competition. Setif finishing with just 5 points, 1 win and 2 draws and 3 losses. A much poorer showing than I think their own fans and most of us expected. As to who's going to win those semifinals, Sonny, well, the fact that they won the groups and won them impressively, I guess makes USM Alger of Algeria and Mazembe of DR Congo favourites. They're also favoured in the sense that they have the second legs at home. The group runners-up have home advantage first. And it seems like most coaches much prefer to play the second match at home. But of course, Sonny, if you build a decisive first-leg lead, let's say you win 2-0, 3-0, then I think that theory goes out the window. I think it's very difficult to come from, say, 3-0 behind after the first leg. So let's give a tentative plug to a final between USM Alger and TP Mazembe in the CAF Champions League.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. It's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Namdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Namdi, how about an update on Africans in the ring?
Sonny, if you remember, we talked about a good African heavyweight from Douala, Cameroon. He fought on national TV here in America, and we all saw it. He got robbed when he fought Chris Ariola. Check this. Fred Cassie from Douala will go against American heavyweight Dominic Brazil. Dominic Brazil is 15-0 with 14 knockouts. He's a 2012 U.S. Olympian. It's going to be on live TV Saturday night, and it's going to be a good crap because I believe homeboy from Douala, Cameroon, can knock out the undefeated American heavyweight who has been pampered.
Namdi, I remember you talking about the Ugandan lion, Sharif Bogere, and you kind of warned him that going to Mexico might not be such a good idea, that he could get robbed. And in fact, that seems like what happened. No contest in his most recent fight.
He's lucky he escaped with no contest. Might as well call that escape from Alcatraz, man. We said it before, man. He's lucky he escaped with no contest. And this will teach his management a lesson. You don't take your star to Mexico. Come on, man. You're a manager. You need to make the deals. You need to make the move. You need to have the swagger. That's why we need to have an African star. You don't take an African star to a backyard in Mexico. They are lucky they escape with a no contest, man. I said it before the fight, son.
So you think the Ugandan lion should stick with either Los Angeles or Vegas?
That's it, LA or Vegas. Don't tangle with Mexicans in Mexico, man.
Namdi, looking down the road, November, maybe the best fight of the year, Miguel Cotto against Canelo, the red-headed Mexican. What's the latest on that?
Ah, Sonny, I can't wait. Believe me, I'm going to be ringside for this one because it's going to be the best action fight of the year. Canelo against Cotto, you know, because this will determine who will be the next pay-per-view superstar. You know, not just a superstar, a global star. If Canelo is able to knock out Miguel Cotto, which is possible, and then in the new year take on Triple G, which I believe he can knock out Triple G, then the new pay-per-view king will be Canelo.
The new pay-per-view king. I like that, Namdi. Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta. Finally, in tennis, Yannick Noah, the last Frenchman to win a Grand Slam tournament, has been named the country's Davis Cup captain. Noah replaces Arnaud Clément, who was fired last week following a disappointing campaign and growing tension between him and the players. Yannick Noah's biggest success as a player came when he won the French Open in 1983 for his only Grand Slam title. Yannick's son is Joakim Noah, a two-time NBA All-Star for the Chicago Bulls. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up in our feature segment, one of Africa's best-known entrepreneurs shares his ideas on the use of technology and education. And Human Rights Watch issues a report finding that the Gambia is guilty of serious human rights violations. First, here's Oliver Ngoma of Gabon with Lena.
Thank you.
Oliver Ngoma with Lena. Well, one of Africa's best known entrepreneurs is Noah Samara, the chairman and CEO of Yasmi USA. The company manufactures the tablet called Odyssey that is used in schools in rural, low-income, and remote areas of the world. It relies on satellites instead of the internet to reach students with curricula and software tools for learning and teaching. With the solar-charged tablet, students can participate in live classrooms from home. Samara was also the former chief executive officer of WorldSpace, the world's first operating satellite radio network that serves Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. My colleague Yehia Swuhib spoke to Samara recently about his career and the use of technology in education. In today's segment, he talks about how he started WorldSpace and the state of education in Africa.
Over time, I realized that the difference in progress in between Africa and Europe or Africa and the United States was really nothing other than the lack of information in one and the abundance of information in the other. And so the critical question became, how does one create information affluence across this large continent of Africa, or for that matter, even in large parts of Asia? And that's how the idea of WorldSpace initially, and now Yasmi, was born, was really to create information affluence everywhere where there was dearth of information.
You have been quoted as saying that African countries are at the bottom of the ranking as far as education is concerned. In your speeches, you cite studies that show that out of 128 million school-age children in Africa, 17 million will never attend school. To put it bluntly, you say the facts that define education in Africa are not good. So, what, in your opinion, are the key factors that can enrich Africa's future in education?
So, in terms of these facts, first we state them, because if you want to correct a problem, the first place to start is to acknowledge the problem, the magnitude of the problem, so that you can create solutions around that magnitude rather than coming up with solutions that fall short of what needs to be done. So there are four factors, I would say, that are really important in solving the problem of education. One is, the first and most important thing that governments need to do if they want to see change in education is to make large commitments, bold, large commitments in the field of education, because that is the critical building block, the most important infrastructure of all infrastructures. So investing in education and investing boldly in education, not 3-5% of GDP, but much larger amounts of GDP, to really affect and effect change is the most important thing that can happen. Another very important thing to do is to make sure you educate to fit the needs of your student population. So fitting the education to the needs of the student base is a critical element. Another very important element in changing your education status is honoring your teachers, really creating a teacher base, or making teachers very important, not just empowering teachers, but making the job itself as attractive as possible. I think it was Leah Iacocca who said, in a rational society, the best of us would be teachers.
And in our next feature, Human Rights Watch has issued a report finding that the Gambia is guilty of serious human rights violations. Concerns by UN member states include the country's restrictions on the right of freedom of expression, the renewed use of the death penalty, and discrimination and attacks on people in the Basisi of their sexual orientation and gender identity. Reporter Vincent McCurry spoke about the issue with Felicity Thompson of Human Rights Watch and with Imam Baba Lee, who has himself run afoul of the law. He asked Ms. Thompson about the findings of the report.
Well, the Gambian government commits serious human rights violations against virtually anyone who dissents, anyone who criticizes the government. People are disappeared. People are tortured. People are arrested arbitrarily, detained for prolonged periods.
Mm-hmm. And detained for prolonged periods, Imam Lee, you have personally experienced that anger of the Gambian government. Just describe to us your latest kind of encounter with the law. What prompted it?
Well, you may know there was an execution for 9 inmates in August 2012. As an activist and a religious leader who loves really peace, I made my summons against the execution before it's executed. But that does not have any, help. Mm-hmm. He continued, he did the execution. And then they want to Islamize it. And I know it's not Islamic. So I went to my mosque and I have some interviews with some local papers. And since it was published and my summons become known, I become target. Mm-hmm. In a serious manner,
yes.
Receiving many threatening calls, harassment, even at the traffic, till December 3rd, when I was arrested. They picked me up from my home, from my residence, around 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. And since then, I was taken to unknown place in Comunicado,
yeah.
With horrible conditions, tortured, beyond expectation. I just cannot explain it all.
That is really sad. Now, Ms. Thompson, we don't get a lot coming out of Gambia. Do you think the situation there, the fact that it's such a restricted country makes it easier for the authorities to commit these atrocities without worrying so much about what the world will say?
Yeah, it's a very small country, first of all. It's also a country that is very repressive. There's a very tight clampdown on freedom of speech, and it's difficult to get information about the country. There's also a climate of fear that really silences people who speak out against human rights abuses.
Did you find a kind of like a media that is a little independent that can possibly report on such things?
There are media in the country that try to report on human rights abuses. However, many journalists have told me that they must, they report far less than they know.
Mm-hmm. And now, Imam, what is it do you think can be done for the violations there to come to the attention of the world and perhaps put some pressure on the government there?
Well, I believe the international community haven't done a lot about Gambia, maybe because it's not well exposed. As you know, it's hard to see a door, but really, the international community, they always focus where they have interest. That is, Gambia, unfortunately, is a very poor country. They have no oil, no diamond, no even coffee like Abidjan. So, in a nutshell, they don't have much interest there. But really, the atrocities that are taking place as we speak, there are a journalist, Abdoulaye Cisse, who have been abducted for the last 3 months just because he said something that is not in line with what the government wanted to say.
Yeah. So there's no, it doesn't spare anybody. Would you say that other religious leaders like yourself have faced similar persecution?
Yes, there are a lot of religious leaders who were detained. There was one religious leader called Muhyiddin Haidara. He was detained and taken to court. Over 1 year, he's running up and out simply because he prayed day after Eid al-Fitr. And the president is the one to decide when to pray, how to pray, where to pray. If you pray, beside the days he selected, you are in trouble. That was the case of Imam Muhyiddin Haidara. And there are other imams, not only me. There's Bakausu Fofana, who is right now in Kazamas, taking shelter there. There is Imam Ismail Majang, who have been kept quiet completely in Gunjur. Okay. There are many imams for him to count.
That was Felicity Thompson of Human Rights Watch speaking with reporter Vincent McCorry. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Military officers have seized power in Burkina Faso less than a month before elections. General Gilbert Diendéré was declared to be in charge of the West African nation in a statement on national television following the extra-constitutional seizure of power by elements of the Presidential Security Regiment on September 16th. The general was a longtime military advisor to former President Blaise Compaoré. These actions took place 3 days after a government committee recommended dissolving the unit, which was a pillar of Compaoré's 27-year rule. Troops detained interim president Michel Kafando, Prime Minister Yacouba Isaac Zida, and other officials. Political conditions have been unsettled since Compaoré was forced from office last December amid protests over his plans to cling to power by changing the constitution to run for a third term. Tensions increased in April when Kafando signed into law a new electoral code that bars from office individuals who supported Compaoré's effort to eliminate mandated term limits. The new law makes ineligible for the October 11th election those who had publicly backed the ex-president's plan, which was seen as a scheme to extend his 27-year rule. The country's interim parliament voted in favor of the restrictions April 7th, after seven of Compaoré's political allies were arrested for alleged embezzlement. The United States strongly condemns the actions by elements of the Presidential Security Regiment against the civilian-led transition government of Burkina Faso. We strongly oppose all attempts to seize power through extra-constitutional means or resolve internal political disagreements using force. We join the rest of the international community in calling for General Diendéré and the group that accompanied him to step down immediately. We also urge the immediate release of President Kafando, Prime Minister Zida, and all other government officials being detained. It is crucial that the civilian-led transitional government return to continue its work, including preparation for the national elections in October. The people of Burkina Faso deserve nothing less than to see the elections they have worked so hard for over the past year become a reality without delay.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.